Hmm?
Yeah.
Which way did the person you're seeing is going to be gone?
She emailed me and said she's at a meeting and we'll be back on the 15th.
Sure.
Or after the 15th.
Are you done wandering around connecting yourself to the planet?
I am finished with that and I'm recording you now.
Okay. Let's go. First, as usual, any changes to the Catalyst website? I've added one file this morning after I realized that I had forgotten to put it in the book manuscript. It's actually a figure from the previous book that I'll be talking about very soon, and it just somehow didn't appear here where it belongs. It's a picture of what principal coordinate analysis is doing. So it looks like this, and I'll be projecting it like this, and you're welcome to download a copy if you want to study it in more detail. But that's the only thing that's been added since Tuesday. Then we will be talking at some length today about Procrustes analysis, and Joe was pointing out that you might want to do one. So it would be nice if you had code, and way back near the beginning of this Catalyst class website is the code to do this. It's a file called S Procrustes from Scratch. It's just a text file. It looks like this once you upload it. Sorry for the small type. And I think I'll leave that on my computer, because after we get to the part of today's lecture where we describe the actual Procrustes algorithm, which is about 50 years old now, we can go back to this and actually follow it through chunk by chunk of code. The program is just doing what the book says. Same as the thin plate spline software that's we'll get to Tuesday. Likewise, the program is just doing what the formulas say. So we'll get back to that. Okay. Then I forgot, or I ran out of time, or I chose to run out of time on, wrong window. On Tuesday, before talking about the one piece of the singular, the one application of the singular value decomposition that we're going to be using before we use principal components. We have some examples here of principal components, but they weren't examples of principal components of a Procrustes shape. And the first thing we're going to do with Procrustes analysis, once it's introduced in about 20 minutes, isn't principal components analysis. It's something called principal coordinates analysis, which is from about 1958. So principal components happens to be from 1900. It's from a paper by Carl Pearson. So this is essentially half as old, exactly half as old, as principal components. But it's the same algorithm computationally. So that's why it's in chapter 4. Gower independently reinvented this in 1966, John Gower. And this is unusual in that John Gower is still alive. He's 97, I think.
Pretty old.
Yeah, pretty old. He published a book 2 years ago at 95. Yeah. It shows that statistics is very good for you in terms of longevity. Should you at this late stage still be looking
for writing
a business card?
Or writing books, apparently. He's also a very nice guy.
Mm-hmm. I've met him once or twice, and yes, he's a nice man. Not British so much as English. Okay, so
the rest of the lecture will be devoted to explaining that distinction.
No, we're not talking about constitutional law today, I promise. Okay, so you remember, or at least I'm going to pretend you remember, that this is the equation of the singular value decomposition. I'm on page 54 of chapter 4 for anybody who's following. And we wrote this for general rectangular matrices, but it was also true for square matrices. Symmetric square matrices, like covariance matrices among some number of variables. And when we applied it there, those two sets of columns, U and V, have to be the same matrix. So it's this equation for principal components analysis. It's this equation for the biplot. It's this equation for just the covariances. So now let me pretend to change the subject. And it's that that this figure will be relevant to. So first off, we're going to be going from here to here on the figure. We're going to be starting from a matrix that is just part of the surface Z equals XY, and we're going to be ending up with a surface that looks like this, which is just a very nice paraboloid in which every point is at a height equal to the square of the difference of its subscripts. So this is these are numbers from 1 to from minus 4 to 4, from 1 to 9. This is minus 4 to 4, 1 to 9. This is plotted at height 64, because minus 4 minus 4 is 8, minus 8. This is at height 0 because that's the diagonal. These are the same. So this is a very nice, easy surface. And this is the one we were talking about Tuesday. So let's start then with the equation of that surface, with the expression of that surface as a matrix, the Z equals XY surface. And all it is as a matrix is the product of each X times each Y. Or in this case, I'm using the X's and the Y's are the same, so it's each X times every X, every other X. So these are the squares of the X's, and this is X1 times anything, and this is anything times X1, and so on. And this looks exactly like a rank 1 matrix from equation 411 if the two things you're multiplying are the same vector. So we're going to fiddle with this matrix. We're going to play around with it. So we've got a diagonal here. Write it down. Multiply the original matrix by minus 2. Don't ask why we're doing this till we get there. To every row of minus 2 times the matrix, add the original diagonal and also add it to every column. And you end up with a matrix we're going to call D squared, because each entry turns out to be the square of the difference of the original two X's. All we did was write down this equation in matrix form. So like here, this is where that minus 2 came from, for instance, and this is the diagonal, and this is the diagonal.
And that's a xi minus, the minus sign is not clear.
Yeah, sorry.
Clear there.
Yeah, that's a minus.
Yeah.
Okay. And that's a plus. So all we're doing is noticing that. Then if we start with these, we can get to these. The method of principal coordinates analysis is exactly the same thing in reverse order. You start with these, and by following the instructions, which are very simple, and it's one inch of math code, you get back to where that drawing is. You get back to these. And it's easiest actually to see that on the figure that I just gave you this morning. So we're starting with the squared differences of your x's. Suppose you have 9 cases. We'll number them from minus 4 to 4 here, just for convenience of graphing. And I'm assuming for the moment they're equally spaced. In real data they won't be, but that's part of the fun. So this scale goes from minus 4 to 4. This scale is the same variable, goes from minus 4 to 4. Differences here along the diagonal are 0, and we're going to start talking in terms of distance as dissimilarity. What we mean here by squared distance is how different the ith specimen is from the jth specimen. And if I and j are the same, the difference is 0. And here, if the first specimen is at minus 4 and the last specimen is at plus 4, the difference is 8, the squared difference is 64, and that's where we are. So now you follow the instructions in this direction, which are in the book on page 54. So it looks mysterious, but it works. You take the column averages of this matrix. So you average in the direction my mouse is going. You average in the direction my mouse is going. And you just draw that as a surface. It's the same for every point in the column. And you subtract this from this. And here's what you get. Then back here, you do the same kind of averaging except as rows. So you get this surface rotated by 90 degrees. And you subtract this from that. So we're starting with this, subtracting this thing, and subtracting this thing. This is what we get. And then we multiply it by minus 1/2 and put the grand mean back in, and we get exactly the surface we started with on Tuesday, which we know how to do an analysis of. This is the one principal component data set. Z equals XY. So this says you have one dimension. Here it goes from, it'll be going from minus 4 to 4. And you multiply it by itself to get these, so to speak, covariances. And then if this doesn't exhaust your matrix, you do it again. And you continue doing it until either you run out of dimensions or things start to be no longer significant using the rules for our principal components that we had on Tuesday. Now, it doesn't have to work like this. And that responds to an issue that Joe raised on Tuesday. That twisted surface, Z equals XY, describes some kinds of biological processes and not others. And this method of converting a matrix of dissimilarities, of distances, into a matrix of principal component scores, which is what we're doing, works only if the matrix we started with is kind of close to a matrix of principal component scores, squared distances to begin with. So there are several lovely examples of where it isn't, and here's by far the most relevant one for evolutionary biology. And this is from a paper I published in 2013, which should have been published in 1913, because the result in this paper is the principal coordinates analysis of a random walk, which is what all of our models, yours and mine, are actually doing in evolutionary time. If we follow a single lineage without splitting, without bifurcating, on all of the models we're agreeing on, it's following some sort of random walk. When it does, I'm on the wrong page, this is the surface you get instead of this. Instead of this nice smooth paraboloid, you actually get the intersection of two planes if your data is a random walk, high-dimensional random walk. And if you follow the rules of this computation, so you do this, you take the row averages, subtract them, take the column averages, subtract them, multiply by minus 1/2, add the mean back in. What you get isn't that Z surface, the nice twisted surface. You get this thing, which is a perfectly well-defined mathematical formula. I'll spare you from it. And its eigenvectors aren't the simple straight lines that we were looking at before. It's this series and so on. Oops. Make it smaller, please. Not that much smaller. There we go. It's this series and so on. It's a series of cosines. This is the first principal component. This is the second principal component. Third, fourth, fifth, sixth, and so on until you run out of dimensions. So if your model isn't of a one-dimensional subtraction, and random walks aren't doing that, if for distance, it's the square distance, sorry, square of a one-dimensional subtraction, then the analysis doesn't give you Z equals XY. It doesn't give you the twisted surface. And the ability to recognize this in a data set is probably kind of handy if you're doing evolutionary biology. Let me pause here to ask Joe, I know I sent you this paper when it came out. Had you seen this before it came out, the actual principal coordinate analysis?
Well, not before you called it to my attention.
According to the reviewers, it had not appeared. And I know that because both reviewers of this paper said, I don't believe you, but I checked, and it's right. And that is unusual for a paper in
It was not published in 1913 because you happened not to be alive.
But my grandfather was.
Oh, okay.
My father was.
My father was too.
Yeah. Okay, yeah. So this, as the answer to Joe's general question, it doesn't have to work out in low dimensions. But when it does, when you get a surface that kind of looks like this for square distance, it leads to a simplification in terms of just product of terms. Then probably there's one underlying factor, and each case has a value of it. We're going to see that in about 30 minutes when we do our first Procrustes analysis of a growth data set. But first, we have to introduce all of this. Oh, I'm missing just a couple of final points here. The same way, if you don't like just one principal component, you can go on and take the second one or the third one until you decide to stop. You can do the same thing here. I skipped this. If that's your squared dissimilarities, the computation that gets us to what we're doing the eigenanalysis of is this thing under my mouse. You take one matrix, which is called the centering matrix, multiply it by your data set on both sides, divide and then divide by minus 2, and that's what we're doing the eigenanalysis of. And that was Gower's point, that you can, if whenever you have similarity data, if it comes from a sum of squares, this will give you back the variables you were using for that sum of squares. And if it doesn't come from a sum of squares, it gives you the nearest you could get to reproducing that as a sum of squares, which is a very nice model if the sum of squares means something. And Procrustes' analysis is the all-time best example of constructing a sum of squares that might mean something. I emphasize the word might here. So this is being tied together because Procrustes' analysis is a sum of squares, and because distances that are sums of squares have this unusually easy statistical method. If one dimension doesn't do it for you, just use two dimensions. Just go on. And then here's the connection with Procrustes' analysis in language you haven't seen yet. Okay. That said, now, let's seem to back up and go construct this representation where shape similarity becomes a sum of squares, because that's actually a good idea. And Procrustes coordinates are what shape dissimilarity is the sum of squares of. The presentation here isn't the standard textbook Procrustes explanation. It's not from Zeldich and Sheets. It's not from Mardia and Dryden. I worked it out about 8 years ago when I started teaching this material in Vienna and decided that it was the easier way to present it all. So I'm starting with Procrustes' distance and then getting to the shape coordinates later. This is fair because it will be the same goal. So here we are on page 68 of chapter 5, if you're following along. And I'm starting here with a little, very short discussion of philosophy of science. It matters that some of what's coming up is theory, that we're saying in some biological applications, some pattern's going to be turn out to be true for biological reasons, and we have to distinguish those from theorems, which are properties of mathematics. The singular value decomposition is a theorem. You start with a rectangular matrix, you can write it this way. No mention of biology, astrophysics, or anything else. A theory might say the evolution of the human skull looks like a random walk in Procrustes space, which it does, actually. But other things, like the growth of the human skull, does not look like a random walk in progressive space. That's a theory based on theorems that we can draw the mathematics of these distances, these dissimilarities. So that's the distinction here. We're going to be using theorems about what shape distance might mean. It's here at the bottom of page 68. And what we're going to do is actually start the easiest way. When you have a data set that has a bunch of shapes, the easiest way to start is to produce the distance between any two of those shapes, if they have landmarks. A distance between any two of those shapes. And it's a particular distance called the Procrustes distance. This has been around for a while. And I'm going to show you some aspects of it, and then give you the way that the analysis works just from those distances. And then we'll come back, probably about 11:30, to this notion of shape coordinates, which is the variables that give you these sums of squares, give you this Procrustes distance. So we're doing the distances first, and then coming up with coordinates. In computation, ordinarily you do it the other way. You do the coordinates first and then the distances, but you don't have to. So here I am on page 70. We're looking at a picture here, which has 25 landmarks at the centers of these circles, the little dots, and around them are circles of various radii that are the same at every one of the 25 landmarks. And this is going to be a distribution of all possible forms on those 25 landmarks. We're going to be making statements about how the locations of those 25 points covary. We've already said each of them has the same variance as a distribution in two dimensions. And so we get to decide how we want the associations between these points to be. The standard model for nothing doing here, which is like the standard model for a bell curve, for total independence, for pure noise, says each of those points is doing the same circular Gaussian process independently of all the others.
If I can... Addendum. A circular Gaussian process does not mean a Gaussian process that wanders on a circle. It means one that varies in both x and y directions independently and equally. So contours of the normals are circular.
Yeah, we had a picture of that a few chapters ago. Let's see if I can find it. That was right, of course. It's a technical picture, of course. It's almost always right when he interrupts me. When he's wrong, it's because I'm wrong too. I'm trying to go back and also hold my page at the same time. Excuse me a moment. Now, we have seen this in chapter 2. Come on. There we go. I won't bother turning to it. It's this thing, except with a circle instead of an ellipse. So it's what we mean by a circular Gaussian is this, but without the directionality. Okay, so we've got 25 of those, and we can imagine a world in which some sample of organisms, creatures, pieces of creatures, is distributed like this. And here's a sample from that world. In this picture, I'm now on page 71. So here's the average configuration we're starting with, turns out to be a perfect grid. And here's a collection of forms that are really pretty close to that average. Here are 10 of them. They're at distance, I think it's about This is misaligned. They're distance 0.02, 0.04, 0.06, 0.08, 10, 12, 14, 16, 18. And you can see that as they get farther and farther from this template, from this ideal organism, they're also becoming more and more unlikely to be organisms. This is the distribution that the standard principal components of Procrustes distance is using as the signal of nothing going on. And the point I'm making here is that is not a distribution you are ever likely to find in a real biological data set, because no sample ever looks like this one or any of its columns. It just doesn't. That's because forms are more tightly tied together than this model would say. This model says every landmark is varying independently, and in reality, that just isn't true. There are factors that give correlated variation between the landmarks, and then there's leftover stuff. In the fishes that Joe is simulating for your exercise, he put in the factors. There are three of them, I think. Maybe four? Three or four. Two or three. Two shape factors and maybe size. Three shape factors and maybe size.
Two shape factors and a size that was allometrically correlated with one of them.
Yeah, right. And then something like this for what's left over that we don't want to explain. So one of the ways you can get to ascertaining what the biological signal actually is to reject this model and find the first few principal components, and then hope that the rest looks like this model so you can skip it. The other way you can get to it, we're going to be talking about a week from today, is to write down the next model I'm about to show you, in which the motions of nearby landmarks are all correlated to begin with. And this is the alternative that makes a lot more biological sense. And the way it looks is easy enough to sketch. I'm on page 72 now. I'm just going to build it by, instead of treating that grid as 25 landmarks, I'm going to build it hierarchically. First, I have its outer corners. And for them, I'm actually going to do what Procrustes says. I'm going to just put independent circular Gaussians. You remember the definition at each of these four points. And then, after that is sampled, I'm going to put a circular Gaussian of less variance around the middle. And then, after that is sampled, I'm going to put four more circular Gaussians of even less variance around the middle of those four triangles. That's not the middle, the middle of the base. And then after those are sampled, I'm putting four more of even more variance around the middle of those squares. And you can imagine doing this indefinitely, but I'm stopping here with this sample of 13 points, which is a deformation of the extremely even thing that I started with as an average, which looks like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13. So it's a deformation of that regular grid, and if you rotate that 90 degrees, you'll see it's a square grid, right? This is a square grid. So we're starting with a square grid, just like we did before, but we're putting all of this biologically possible structure on it by forcing the correlations among neighboring points. This point has got to be located given the prior setting of those two and so on. So this is a square grid, but we're sampling it to show correlation. The method of integration we're going to get to in my very last lecture is like that. But you can see already, here I'm on page 74, that this gives you something that looks quite different from what we had over here. It's different from that, because as I drive this to be more and more violently variable, I don't get that, let me make that a little smaller, I don't get that crumpling. Instead, I get much more realistic, severe changes of shape. And in your copy of the book, it's the difference between these changes, which couldn't be biologically real. These organisms wouldn't survive. Versus these changes, which really do look something like, let's say, the range of skull shape in the mammals or in the birds, ranges of wing shape, things like that. So it is possible to imagine two kinds of models for the same sort of distribution, which is going to be distributions of landmarks. One model says no correlations, and the other model is going to say some particular pattern of correlations that is going to come from a theory or a theorem. Principal Components doesn't care which of these you use. And what we're going to be doing in the sequel is first doing the analysis with respect to the Procrustes data, with respect to these pictures, this picture, and then at the very end doing the analysis with respect to a very realistic model of correlations. So that if the model fits, which it will half the time, we've learned something important. The model of no principal components against Procrustes data, against the Procrustes model, never fits data. It only fits residuals. The model of no residuals from a particular pattern of integration fits human evolution data and fits an aspect of mammal data and fits mosquito data up to the aerodynamics of it and fits lots of other things. So we're going to continue to use principal components, but we're trying to be biologists here. Okay, so model or no model, what is this Procrustes distance business? And here, if you're all following in the book, we just turn to page 77, where we go through this particular routine left to right. And this doesn't actually make much sense until you play with it. Until, for instance, you check that it gives you a reasonable result when you apply it to triangles of landmarks, although here we've got four of them. When I first started working with this, which was more than 20 years ago, I didn't believe that this could make any sense until I found out that its geometry was that of the geometry of registered triangles of Buxton shape coordinates, which we did 2 weeks ago, which did make sense. So here's the standard algorithm for Procrustes distance. And we're applying it here to two sets of 4 points that come, you can't see it, but they come numbered 1, 2, 3, 4. So here's 1, here's 1, here's 2, here's 2, here's 3, here's 3, here's 4, here's 4. And these are kind of similar shapes, reasonably acceptable if you were doing biology. And so we go through the following steps. We average the 4 points, meaning just take the add up their coordinates, divide by 4. So this isn't the center of the rectangle, the center of the trapezoid, the center of the quadrilateral. It's just the average of the 4 points. That's the dot here or the dot here. We put those down, the two dots at the center, in the same place. So here, I've left this one alone, and I've copied this one up. And if you just sort of look at that, you can see, well, this second form seems like it's kind of rotated with respect to the first one. So let's just undo that. Let us rotate it back this way until the sum of squares of these distances becomes as small as it can. And again, I haven't yet explained why this is a sensible thing to do. But it is something you can do. And when you do that, you get this. Remember, that point is fixed, and I've now rotated that back until it's close to here, and I've, with that rotation, moves this down to nearly there, and puts that almost exactly there, and puts this up there, and I get this. And now I erase this structure of rotating, or of centering and rotating. I just delete that point, delete the lines, and this is what I'm left with. That thing up at the right is the Procrustes superposition of the two forms. What we've really done is compute a way of putting one picture down on top of the other picture with the closest fit. Closest in the sense of the sum squared distances between the corresponding points after we're done. That sounds like a regression. Least squares fit of something times one variable to another variable. In fact, it is a regression in two dimensions. And the code that I set up, wherever I left that, can be rewritten as a complex regression. Did I do it that way? Yeah, I actually wrote this as a regression. This is a regression equation in my subroutine. It's not calling the regression package, it's just writing out the equation. But back where we were, this now does start to make sense. We are saying, in effect, for the purposes of some application, which we haven't yet specified, the place where these forms started on the page or on the digitizer doesn't matter. And their size doesn't matter. I forgot to say we've also standardized the sum of squares of these lines to one before we went any further. So we've standardized position, and we've standardized size, and we've standardized rotation just to get to a minimum sum of squares, a best superposition. And after you do that, you even erase the quadrilaterals because Procrustes' distance squared is just the sum of the areas of those circles divided by pi. So if you're in a biological situation for which position doesn't matter, size doesn't matter, and orientation doesn't matter for the question, this might be a sensible thing to do. I've been writing papers for the last few years saying all of the different ways in which position does matter, size does matter, and orientation does matter. And you do have to ask yourself, before you launch into any of these computations, are you in such a situation? Lots of examples will be coming up as we talk through the rest of the chapter, but here's one. Suppose you're studying a galloping horse. Well, it gets its energy from a cheetah, an animal that whose backbone bends as it gallops, or a greyhound. Then the energy of the curving of the backbone is derived from rising and falling over the land. So for a biomechanics like that, going up and down affects the energetics of the system. So Procrustes wouldn't work. Or for any animal that's growing allometrically, any animal for which forms at big size are different from forms at little size, like Galileo's mouse and elephant comparison, you need to at least keep track of size. So you can say the big ones are shaped differently from the small ones. Even if you are dividing out size the way we just did it here, you want to remember that that's not a biologically sensible thing to do. Or again, for a fish, fish swim forward, usually. And so you can't rotate a fish. Forward is forward. It's defined by the ocean, not by the fish form. So rotating a fish doesn't make too much sense, but it makes a wonderful example. Displacing the center of a fish does make sense, because swimming at different depths is comparable. And scaling a fish turns out to make sense because most fish actually grow without shape change. Most fish grow isometrically, whereas animals, primates, don't grow isometrically. So Joe and I are working on moderately important modifications of this analysis that leave size in. And one of them is mentioned here, we'll get to it in 2 days. It's what we're calling Boas coordinates. Boas was the anthropologist who published this without the size correction in, God help us, 1905. Many good ideas and statistics were published an incredibly long time ago and were just overlooked. This is one of those. Procrustes' analysis is roughly 1960. Boas' analysis, which is this without the size correction, is 1905. My father was 1 year old. He wasn't paying attention. Nevertheless, if this model of independent variation at the different points is reasonable, and if this model of not caring about position, not caring about size, not caring about rotation is reasonable, then you can prove, and it's not even that hard, that when you're done with all of this, you should get no principal components. Everything should be spherical, regardless of what the average shape of your landmarks was. And that's an important theorem. So I'm saying we have here a procedure which, if this is the model, then it doesn't matter where those points, where those circles actually are on the page. It will still tell you you don't have principal components. And so the rejection of that model will tell you you do have principal components, and this is good to know. This is the reason people use for Krusty's analysis, because for many applications, particularly in systematics, either you don't care about the biology of the situation, you care only about the similarities, or you have forms that are so similar to begin with, like all of these microforaminiferous we were looking at from McLeod last lecture. You have such similarity that it's as if this model of variation applies. The model of neutral drift in genetics corresponds to this model in morphology. If genes are changing randomly, the base pairs are changing randomly without correlations, and if morphogenesis is without correlations, which is a long shot but possible, then this model should match your data, and it doesn't matter what the mean landmark positions are. That's the theorem. And it's an extremely powerful one. It was first proven at that level of generality in 1987 by Conti Mardia and a student of his, Colin Goodall, Ian Dryden, as part of Dryden's doctoral dissertation. Well, that's recent, that distribution. It was suspected by David Kendall, but it was already within the 1980s. So this is new mathematics, but directly relevant to biology. That's enough theory, so let's have an example, a real example. In which case, first I have to go back and actually show you the example, because you've seen it before. Page 6 of this chapter, what page am I on? 74, so I'm going back 70 pages, which is 394 here. Get in there. Okay, so the example looks like this. And by now you can recognize that as a human skull sliced up the middle. Brain case, forehead, tip of the nose, bony nose, this point, L, tip of the alveolar ridge at the upper jaw, mandibles missing, spinal cord comes out here, this is the bump at the back of your head, the inion, this is the cranial base inside. This is a familiar form. Now I go back to where I was, going forward 68 pages, so that was 462. Nope. Here we go. So what I've got is a data set that looks like, again, I'm jumping around because it's the first time I've taught from this, and it's not entirely clear what order the figures should be in. So in here somewhere is a set of all of those forms, and I'm just looking for that picture. Hello. Give me a moment. There we go. Oh, page 150, so I go forward about another 75 here. 542. Back four. Okay, so you've got a figure here that shows all of the 29 forms we're using. These are shown, each one, as the deformation of the average. That's because this is in the section on thin plate splines. But here are 29 forms. And it's the same as the 29 forms that are going to appear in the figure we're going to go back to. So here's a male chimpanzee, 20 landmarks. Female chimpanzee, same 20 landmarks. Mrs. Pless, an Australopithecine that they're not really sure about the gender of, 29 landmarks. Atapuerca, Petrolona, Cabwe, and Guattari, all Neanderthals. A 2-year-old child, a 4-year-old child, another 4-year-old, a 10-year-old, two 14-year-olds, a 17-year-old, and then these A's are 16 adult Homo sapiens, of which one of them is an archaic from a cave in Czechoslovakia, Mladic, so it's called Mladic. So this is a typical sample of forms of something that's probably all the same lineage, should have been all the same genus if people weren't so wild about renaming genera of primates. They're all hominoids. They're all the same family. So there's 29 of them. And the thin plate spline is a good device of looking to see, well, yeah, there's a feature here we'll get to in a bit. There's a feature here we'll get to in a bit. This stuff we'd like to know a little bit more about. So there's your sample. I mean, I'll go back. About 60 pages, maybe around 468. And for every pair of those, we can produce the Procrustes distance. No talk yet about shape coordinates. We just have the landmarks. So we have, 29 specimens. There's 29 times 14, which is 406. Interform distances plus the zeros. So you go into the algorithm I gave you, that one that starts with this and goes to this in one or more dimensions, and you get this. You really do. And it's telling you something you already knew, but it's telling you in different language. It is telling you this isn't a very good data set to be doing multivariate analysis on, because you got somewhere between 3 and 4 groups here. And the assumption of multivariate analysis always was you're doing something that's pooled over groups. You're using covariances, and those have to be expected values, and they have to be expected over something. Sampling of a population. But we've got 2 chimpanzees, a male and a female, and they're different, and then an adult Australopithecine, and then we have these 4 Neanderthals who do look kind of similar in this plot of the first 2 dimensions. Oh, why the first 2 dimensions? It turns out that the numbers you get from the singular value decomposition are... Oh, where the hell is that? I can't just jump to the page, but the numbers you get are 29, 19, 14, 11, and so forth. And 29 is different from 20, and 20 is different from 14, and 14 isn't different from 11. So it's 29 and 20, and you stop. The rules we had on Tuesday's lecture say you stop here. I'm sorry, that applies to the picture below it. I take that back. This picture probably has some more dimensions, but they're irrelevant because we violated the assumptions. This can't be a biological process, because we've already named these as 3 different genera, and these are 2 different species, Neanderthalensis and sapiens. And this is Australopithecus, and this is Pan. So while this is comforting, it means, yeah, 18th century taxonomy was doing a good job, Linnaeus was a smart guy, there's no reason to be doing multivariate analysis here. In the publication this is taken from, in the publication this is taken from, therefore, we said what I just said, and threw out these, because we already knew they were different. And now for the Neanderthals versus everybody else, we get this. It's the same Procrustes distances, but it's now only 26 of the specimens instead of 29. So the matrix that we're multiplying left and right by H and then dividing by minus 2 is 26 by 26. Still no variables in this world, just landmark locations. And the sample is down to 26. And again, something is wrong, because this first principal component, first principal coordinate, is the difference between sapiens and Neanderthals. And we already knew that. They're two different species. No matter what the genetics says about overlap, we overlap about 3%. So this, again, isn't a sample worth studying. So?
Well, it's a sample. If you divide it into two samples, would be able to do comparisons.
You don't need this to do comparisons. You just average these, and there's one comparison to be shown. But in terms of multivariate analysis, looking for structure, this is still not promising. So let's throw out those Neanderthals, because they already knew they were Neanderthals. And now, finally, we get an analysis that is worth keeping. This is now a reasonably homogeneous group. These are the babies, ages 2 and 4. The adolescents are kind of mixed in here. These are kind of all the adults. But if you look at the numbers that are generated by this procedure, you get, and here's what I was trying to do, you get 29, 14, 11, and so on. 29 is different from 14. 14 is not different from 11, and so on. And therefore, it's 29, it's a first dimension plus one of these.
So those numbers are the...
Those are the eigenvalues,
of
the principal component version of this when we compute later. Because to get those numbers, you have to have the shape coordinates. But to interpret those numbers, all you need to know is the meaning of the dimensions on this plot. So except for the first dimension of what's being plotted here, except for the horizontal, the data look like this. Just, you can't rule out the model of identical circular variation at every one of those 20 landmarks, even though you know that can't be quite right because two of them they come in pairs, right? You remember there was top and bottom of the picture, top and bottom, inside and outside of lambda, inside and outside of inion. But this first principal component will turn out to be talking about all of those local features. I'll jump ahead to show it to you in a minute. Unless I remember where and how I put it. 4, 5.
In a moment, allow me to interrupt you.
It's coming on page 573, say. Where is it? 567. Yeah, so the principal component that we're getting, number, damn it. Come on. I have this down at home. Is it 545? Well, it'll turn up. Sorry about that. But it is the case that when we get to the principal components of this data, which uses the in-place spline picture, the principal component will be showing the local features that we know have to be there by moving the inions apart, for instance, because that's how growth works. And so it's reasonable to state that what's left over from this first dimension is circular noise. Even though we knew that nearby landmarks were correlated, all of those correlations together are handled by one factor. And this is important if it corresponds to your data, because it tells you how to write it up. We haven't yet used shape coordinates, but we're about to. Joe, your hand is vibrating.
Yeah, I'm concerned that you introduced Procrustes
distance.
I want to make sure before we go further into the data analysis and showing examples that people really got how that distance works.
Mm-hmm.
It was taking two forms that have landmarks.
Same landmark.
And you're going to do what? You're going to superpose their means.
Their centers, their centroids.
Their centroids. The centroid being the average of the points, a point in
the average of the landmark, right?
Superpose those. And then what? Rotate them.
No, and then scale.
Scale them arbitrarily.
Not arbitrarily.
No. And rotate them so as to minimize the sums of squares of distances between
the corresponding landmarks.
Right. So it's a measure of allowing location, scaling, and rotation to accommodate how close are these two points when measured by a least squares
formula. Right.
Is that, I hope, clear to everybody? Now we're going to, what you're doing here is to use the table of distances,
which is 29 by 29,
and do this principal coordinates thing, which is it's really an exact equivalent to principal components.
Mm-hmm.
And I have an intuitive explanation.
I'm sorry, I have a call from my wife. I have to take it.
Okay.
Hello? Hello?
It's a pocket call. I don't have to. Okay.
Yeah, right. Yeah, good. Continue.
Yeah, I have a way of explaining principal coordinates. Maybe I'm getting ahead of your presentation.
Try it out.
Okay. Basically, if you take a cloud of points in space and do principal components, you're going to choose a direction through them that has the most variation. That's the first principal component, and one orthogonal at right angles to that that has the next most variation, and so on. Now, if you take those points, and you could rotate them around and move them around in the space, the principal components don't change. They're still passing through the same parts of the cloud. If I take this set of Procrustes distances, I can construct a set of points by what's the term?
You've just written the caption for this figure.
Okay.
You've constructed this set of points.
Yeah. That basically I can construct a set of points by going blank on the term. What's the term when you use distances to successively construct points?
Coordinates?
No. I'm sorry. I'm missing a word in the English language.
Ordinate?
No. If somebody gives me the distances among points and I, in space...
Oh, you're relaxing a network.
No, it's nothing that...
I'm sorry.
Anyway, from those distances, I can come up with a bunch of points that will have those distances.
Multidimensional scaling.
No, it's simpler than that. It'll pop into my brain.
Okay.
And so what we're doing is taking the distances. In effect, although we do direct operations on the distances according to Gower's algorithm with these H's and things, what it's really in effect doing is coming up with a set of points that has those distances and then doing principal components on them.
No.
I mean,
that's not what it's really doing.
Well, it's not what it literally does.
These are mathematically equivalent.
They're equivalent.
There is no really here.
Well, the point is that you don't see it doing that in the algorithm.
Yes, you do.
It gets the same.
That's why I explained it this way.
You do see
it doing that way in the algorithm by this explanation, and you don't by your explanation. You don't see it. Gower explained it starting with distances. That's correct. The textbooks often explain it starting with coordinates. That's also correct. The fact that you get the same answer, that's also correct. You can explain it any way you want. Either way, you have your choice.
Okay, the way I explained it this way, however incorrect.
It's not incorrect, but it is not reducing it to principal coordinates, to components. They are the same algebra. They are the same.
I'll accept that.
So anyway, if this matches your data, if you have one dimension and the rest is circular noise, that's important. And I, while Joe was talking, I found the figure I wanted, which is on 357. So I go forward 77 here. 469 and 77 is it's about 530. Yeah. Okay, another 15. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15. Okay, here we go. So it's this figure over here for that smaller set of 22. And we're getting ahead of ourselves. This is from the last lecture. The way you draw a principal coordinate is as a thin plate spline, and here it is going forward over growth. So it's from the babies to the bigger ones. And this is a picture of the growth of the normal human skull. Brain grows more slowly, maxilla grows more quickly, horizontally. If you go backward, you get this, which is the opposite dimension. And relative warp 2 makes sense as a picture. It's vertical in the maxilla, but we just ascertained it doesn't make sense as a principal coordinate. This is a very nice picture, but there's no signal for it in the data. So your story stops here. You just say this and the last scatter plot that we had, I'll get back to it in a minute for teaching purposes, and you stop, you're done. When that works, it's really good. It saves you from writing, it saves you from over-interpreting your data, it saves you from saying, oh yeah, and we have a factor here for vertical growth in the maxilla, but there's not very much of a signal here for it, is there? No, there's no signal for it at all. Back on page 469, I think that was. Yeah, back here, the analysis says this second component isn't meaningful. Everything after the first one is just spherical, which means stop talking. So we're actually making some progress here in doing biology, which means if you had 20 points to start with, 40 coordinates, it's really nice to boil it down to one sentence or one figure, one pair of figures, and stop. Instead of saying separately what's going on here, what's going on here, what's going on here, you have what's going on everywhere. And, I forgot to show you where those points were moving apart. I'm actually going to jump back to that because I want to make that point. So back to 469, it was, went forward 87, so it's 555 roughly. 57. Back to 545. Okay, go back where we were here. If you look to see how it's growing, you will see those correlations of nearby points I was telling you about. Lambda and, say, internal and external Brugmann are doing roughly the same thing. Internal and external lambda doing the same thing. The inions are doing something different. They're moving apart with growth. And these along the maxilla are moving apart with growth, and the brain case is getting smaller relatively with growth. And you're allowed to say that now. It isn't news. People have known that for about 100 years in human evolution, but it's very comforting. And when this paper appeared in the Journal of Anatomical Record, it appeared in 1999 to show people that this method could be used confidently, because when you apply it to a data set whose signal you know, you find what you expect to find. So trust it elsewhere. There's a modification of this that leaves size in. It's called form distance. Running a little low on time for this, so I'll skip it for now, but it's there. I went back to 567, because now I want to show you the Procrustes algorithm that actually is, 567? No, make that 467. Okay. Oh, here's for the 20. Here's the numbers for the 29 cases. 23, 0, 3. So the second dimension is weaker. 16 and 13. So this is where you stop. These are very different. These are very different, factor of two. These two aren't. So you stop. So that full data set of all the genera had two dimensions, but not very interesting. And when we reduced it by throwing away those three subsets, we only get one. Okay, now turn, well, we're done with 5.3. Let's do 5.4, which is starting at page 85, it says. Six more. Okay. Back to the rat data. So, this will take less time because you've already heard two-thirds of it. And Joe just gave you the transition you need. Principal component seems to be talking about variables. Principal coordinates is talking about distances. It produces the variables for which your matrix was the distances. Can we produce those variables directly from a Procrustes analysis? Yes, they're called Procrustes shape coordinates.
Before you get there, I remembered the word triangulation.
Thank you.
Triangulation. Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you. Very good.
Back to what
you're
saying.
Okay. You're right. Okay. So here's an algorithm.
Okay.
I'm on page 89. And thank you, Joe. I now realize that's the word you wanted. Here's an algorithm on page 89. I think you have it in color because you've got electronic copies. And here, is it this one? Hello. Here is the code that you've got on the website corresponding to that algorithm. So it's just not very complicated. The final plot here in the code is the figure on the next page. This is the final plot over here. But before that, let's follow through what we're doing. And it's very close to what Joe just said. That needs to be bigger. Not that much bigger. Let's leave it here. Okay, so here's a sample. It's just four quadrilaterals in this case. We just draw it out, first one, second one, third one, fourth one. They're colored differently, or plotted with different symbols. And we just pick one arbitrarily. Take the first one. Fit everything to it. Remember, the first one was arbitrary. So here's figure, the first form fitted to the first form. So there's only one picture. Second form fitted to the first form. They're kind of centered correctly and sized correctly, and you can see that rotating won't help. Anything that it helps for one point makes worse for the others. Third form fitted to the... Oh, that's on my screen. First form, fourth form fitted to the fourth, to the first form. So we get four of these fits, one for each specimen, and the first specimen is no different from the others. Average the fits. That's this frame. I'm going to blow it up on the next plot, so don't worry about it. And then do this again. Do the whole thing again using the average instead of the first form. The theorem says, for reasonable data, this process will converge as you go around and around. It will converge quickly. It converges exponentially more than quadratically. It will converge to the form that has the least sum of squares to all the forms you started with. That's what we mean by the Procrustes average. And the coordinates you get when you're done are, to a very good approximation, the coordinates that, if you square the differences and sum, give you the Procrustes distances of the matrix we started with in the previous section. This sounds like a miracle. And when Gower presented it, but when the first people were presenting Procrustes analysis, they basically said, this is too good to be true. But it is not too good to be true. This one algorithm, which is called generalized Procrustes analysis, is the algorithm that every package uses. And this algorithm just published by Gower about 50 years ago. You read in the data as coordinates. I'm converting it here to complex numbers just so I can do the regression. I can do this rotation and scaling as one operation. I center them by sweeping out the averages, is how you do it in R. I scale it to unit size. It's how you do it in R. I sweep out the size, square root of the sum of squares around the mean.
I guess at the Procrustes mean. I'm just averaging these, but I can guess at anything. And then I set up the iteration, and I'm setting up a variable that keeps track of how close I come. And here I need only 5 loops to have it update by less than 10 to the minus 20th cycle by 10 to the minus 10th cycle by cycle. So that's actually printed out somewhere. Where is it printed? I forget. That's pretty. When you run this, it prints out. So for each case, you rotate it, and this is the formula for a complex regression. And if you don't understand it, that's okay. You just copy it. This is a complex regression coefficient. You scale it back up to 1 because regression estimate is shrunk, and we're done. This is the convergence criterion. You average those to get your new test mean, and you're finished. Then there is a question of what coordinate system you use for the printing. And we're going to pick the coordinate system that makes our formula for the uniform component easy. So the rest of this, oops, sorry, I didn't mean to do that. Yeah, how should I rotate this picture is the question. Here's the black points all being the averages of the fits of the colored sets to the black points. So this is at convergence. It's optimal. And here are the shape coordinates, just the variation around for each point. 0, 0 is the black point. Those are the shape, Procrustes shape coordinates. And over here in the program, this computes a rotation to the principal components of this, because we'll need that for doing something later. So that's all there is here to the complete Procrustes shape coordinate method. It's this followed by principal components, or pictures, or thin plate splines, or whatever. But everybody's algorithm is the same. It's always this one. So if you do that for the data set we were looking at, it was on page 97, I think. Let me get this off the screen now, make this a little smaller back to where I was, 97, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. If you do that for the data we had, for the 22 cases, the one that had a first principal component, you get something that now looks a little more plausibly like independent circles. When we started, do I have that figure? No, I don't. That'll be another complication. That's something else missing, sorry. When you start with the 29 forms, there are little whiskers growing out of all these segments. They're of no use. But when we're done here, it's plausible that this could be expressing just one principal component plus noise. And the small forms, the young forms have big brain cases, so they're out here, and the older forms have small brain cases, so they're in here. And you can check that if you want to. We're about to later on in the text. Do I want to? Well, actually, yeah, we can check that. Let's check it right now by doing the following. We're going to average the instructions that first principal component gives us for moving from the youngest 3 points to moving across that principal coordinate plot we have. So back here, I'm just going to draw the effect of moving on the plot from here to here on that principal component. Principal coordinate. It's a direction in shape space. It's actually a first principal component, so we can draw it. It's easy. So if you go from here to here, it's the one dimension we've got. What happens to the position of these points? And this is one of the pictures that Joe asked you to draw for the fishes. This is a picture of the first principal the first and only principal component of the data as a set of coordinated displacements. So this was your homework from last week, right? That you asked them to do this for the fish.
This was the, not homework, but the exercise. The exercise. Class exercise.
Yeah, this was the exercise. So yeah. Doing, let me make that bigger so you can see the lines a little better. Probably a little vague here. Here we go. Yep. So what we've got is an analysis that started with 29 forms and their distances, reduced it to 22 forms and one dimension that was meaningful. And now this is a picture of what happens when you grow that dimension. Whatever it means, it's going to turn out to be growth because we have two-year-olds at one end and adults at the other end. The effect of that dimension is, in shape space, to move this point down, move this point up, meaning the brain is smaller because this is lower, less brain. Move this point, these points out, that's the front of the maxilla, and we see that a little better in the thin plate spine, but you can even see it here. That's moving this way. Move the two inions, internal and external, apart a lot. This bone is getting a lot thicker here where the nuchal muscle attaches. This is the attachment of the muscle that holds your head straight. And the opening of the cranial base has moved relatively backward. The whole maxilla is forward on the spinal cord, which is why this muscle has to be bigger to balance it. And this is a lot. This is even more severe for the big apes, for the gorillas and the big male chimpanzees.
Could I just ask a quick question of the class?
Yeah.
Why is he saying that as you grow, the top of your head comes down? How could that possibly be true? Yeah. Obviously.
Of course, that isn't what I said. You left out a crucial word.
I did, but I want them to see.
Yeah. What is the crucial word that we left out?
You answer.
It's scale, right?
Yeah!
It's just,
yes.
Yeah.
You don't
put yes, no, it's scale. Exactly.
It's scale. The children, that's a good
thing. Because babies have giant, like, alien heads.
They have giant alien heads, but they're, of course,
yeah.
Small.
So yeah, we have scaled these as part of the Procrustes procedure. And it is not obvious that that is a biologically appropriate thing to do. In this case, the anthropologist got here 100 years before us and said the brain case is relatively smaller in adults than it is in infants. Maybe you don't know that. Maybe you also want to know if the brain case is absolutely smaller in adults than it is in infants. If that's your question, Procrustes isn't the answer. But something we're going to talk about in before the end of the course, Boas coordinates, is the answer. So it's close. But good point, Joe. The word relatively smaller is always part of this, and there are ways for it not to have to be there. They don't have those beautiful symmetries about distance, but they give you a different and sometimes more useful set of sentences. So, let's see, where was I here? There's not too much else to say about Chapter 4, because I haven't introduced the thin plate splines yet. Just another example is coming on page 97, which is another growth series. This is those growing rat skulls that I showed you a while ago and Paul Sampson used for his exercise and so on. And each of these is a picture of what one landmark is doing when size is standardized. So when you control for overall size from age 7 to 150 in the rat brain case, these landmarks at the top of the brain case are coming down, relatively, quotes, and the landmarks in the cranial base are moving apart. And you can kind of understand that what we mean by size standardization is some kind of averaging of the height and the length here. But it doesn't make any sense to average those. It doesn't make any sense to average the two dimensions that the rat skull is growing in. And so you'd end up doing a whole lot better if you looked at it like on page 84, and this will be my last slide for today, but I don't know what page I'm on now, so I have to check first. Oops, hello. No, oh, 90, I gotta go back 15. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 14, 15. Okay, so here's the right picture for that analysis, and this is what we were calling form space before. This is that same data set with the size change left in. Interesting. The principal component analysis now says, oh, the first principal component is size. There's some shape non-homogeneity. We'll talk about that a week from today. So H7 are different from all of the others, but the overall first principal component here, the growth effect, does indeed
grow it lengthwise more than it grows it heightwise. What we saw that in the previous figure, because these came down relatively while these moved out relatively. But that word relatively isn't helpful if what you want to talk about is the growth process of the rat. Rather, it grew about 150% this way and about 230% this way. If I think I've got those numbers right, they're somewhere. So this figure is roughly, I think, no, that scaling is wrong. Have I exaggerated it? No. Oh, that's actually about right. Yeah, so this component increased only about 50%, and this one increased about 150%. I'll have to check that figure. So if you're describing growth, you might not want to do the size standardization. But Krusty's method will do the size standardization unless you order it very strictly not to. And so in practice, people will ordinarily do the Procrustes analysis anyway and then put the size back in. You can do that for graphics. You can't do it for the proper understanding of growth.
Or another equivalent statement, I think, is that if in growth everything just blows up and there's no actual changes of shape, or if the changes of shape are independent of where you are in the growth process, then for Krusty's is pretty good. If shape is changing as size changes, then for Krusty's
the description in terms of growth will be misleading. It will be talking about things getting relatively smaller when that isn't what you wanted to talk about. So it's still correct in terms of shape, but shape isn't what you want to talk about. You want to talk about all the different size measures. We're out of time for today. I'm certainly willing to hang around, as is Joe, I think, for questions, but you're free to go because it's 11:52. And I have two more lectures next week. Tuesday will be all about thin plate splines, those pictures we've been jumping ahead to look at because I love them and I invented them. And Thursday we'll be putting everything together, going over all the examples, using all of these techniques to see where this kind of morphometrics can get you, including some preliminary applications to phylogeny. Following that, Joe has all the rest of the lectures to talk about how phylogenetics is, in fact, integrated into this. I will only have given a slightest hint using contrast.
I'm unclear exactly what I'm going to cover, but I think the... you are also supposed to work on projects, and there was a day set aside for people to present projects. I'm open to doing more of that and eating into my lecture time if all of you want to present.
Right.
Instead of someone.
Check figure 5. There's a note to me. Check figure 544. That has to be this last figure. I think this might be the wrong... This might be the wrong size for that.
It looks wrong, yeah.
It looks a little too small.
It is.
I got the code for that. So I would encourage any of you who actually want to do this to dive into this example right away. And as you go through it, match it to the description in the text and that picture of what the GPA is doing, because they exactly match with the extreme convenience that this step does the scaling and the rotating all by itself. It is a complex regression for two-dimensional data, and so you get to cheat here by using complex numbers and taking conjugates, and this really is a regression coefficient, those two lines, and it's worth knowing that.
I am preparing, it's not quite ready yet, an R exercise that I will email to you.
That's what you were doing when you were typing today.
That's what I'm doing when I was typing, and I'm stuck at some point. I'll have to clear it up with Fred. But it will be just a function enabling you, some statements and a function enabling you to read in my fish data and do a Procrustes analysis on it by running this function. I'm not presuming that I know what's inside the function, but I just want to get it to work.
Well, I want to make that into an R function by changing the punctuation and so on.
That, that's probably where I'm stuck.
I'll check with you. A sign operator, an R is an underscore, and here it's a less than minus sign.
I'll check with you afterwards, okay. And we'll get it straightened out.
Okay.
But I'm almost there.
Okay.
I'm gonna switch off the recording. Off.